This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 291 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'd like to introduce our co-hosts. First, we have David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hi. Somebody send warmth. I know we're not supposed to talk about weather, so I'll talk about we're 10 days into crises, and we're less than three months away to be a pilot day. In the nice warm of June and outside of our nation's capital.
Ooh, I dream of that day. I dream of that weather for sure. Can't wait. All right. Also joining us is Rob Mark. Now, normally we say from the Jetwine blog, and he still is from the Jetwine blog. But this past week, Rob, you have been all over the news and the television and everything else, haven't you?
Oh, my heavens. I can't remember how many interviews I have done. And not all of them from Chicago. In fact, the nice folks at Fox brought me out to New York on Friday, and I was on Megyn Kelly's show on the Kelly Files, and that was really a hoot. There were a bunch of us aviation geeks all kind of doing a panel discussion about the Malaysian accident, and it has just been an exhausting week.
I bet. I watched that Fox segment, that show there, and with you and the eight other guests as part of that panel. And I have to say, Rob, there was one, I thought, very important way in which you were distinguished from the other eight.
Okay, because I was the youngest? No, I know.
You had the curliest hair, or more to the point, you had hair.
That's true. But there was one other thing, Rob, which was that when she asked a question of the panel, there was no mistaking where you were coming from just by your facial expressions.
Oh, is that right?
Absolutely.
I haven't even looked at that yet. I haven't even had time.
The other guys were deadpan. You know, they waited to be called on, and then they expressed themselves. But she didn't have to call on you, Rob. You could tell what you thought about that question that she was posing just by looking at your face.
What was really funny?
I also like the hand wave. Now, at the end of the very last question, she said she was asking everybody to raise their hand, and Rob kept going, "Eh," with the wing walk waggle.
Well, you know, what was really funny though is that you know, they had us in that funny stadium seating, 3, 3, and 3, and there were a couple of people there that I knew of. I had never met them before, but. And so all these guys walk in, they're all pilots, and they all say, well, where are we supposed to sit? And the producer says, you can sit anywhere you want. And I said, well, who's going to sit in the first row? And they go, I'm not going to sit in the first row. Oh, no, you sit in the first row. No, I'm not going to go in the first row. I said, oh, for God's sake, I'll sit in the first row. So didn't she ask me the first question? And later on, they all went, see?
That's right. Well, it was a good performance. It was a good show. I enjoyed it. And, of course, this is on the subject of MH370, which we're going to talk about some this episode, and that's still ongoing.
What an exhausting story. Yeah.
Yes. All right. Well, let's introduce our guest. And today we have with us Henry Hartevelt. Henry's an independent travel industry analyst, and he's worked with and advised different hotel brands, airlines, online travel agencies, global distribution systems, and also some of the key industry associations. So Henry gets around a lot, too, and we're really pleased to have you on the show, Henry.
Well, thanks for inviting me back. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to participating in the conversation.
Yes, one of the things that we want to do when we talk about MH370 is talk about what the impact of that is on this industry and what that means and what what we think might happen going forward, sort of irrespective of the outcome of the investigation into the accident itself. So we look forward to that. We've also got some aviation news, some other aviation news we'll talk about. And then, David, do we have an airplane of the week?
Yeah, we're going to move away from all of this airline stuff, and we're going to talk about the Cessna 150.
Wow. Yay! Boy, you've come a long way, David.
Yeah, we got to try to balance. The news is all airlines, and I actually threw a military story in there, so we're trying to get the GA fix in there.
All right, very good. I love it. We've also
I learned to fly on a Cessna 150. It was one of the planes I learned to fly on.
Wow, all
so
right.
So hooray for that.
Okay, good. Let's see, Steve and Grant are back. They're recovering from the air show they were at last weekend, and they're going to bring us an Australia desk report. And I understand that the PCDU guys down there are producing an air show DVD. Wow. I can't wait to see that. Boy, Rob, those guys produce more content than I think any other aviation geeks.
Well, that's because, Steve and Grant don't have real jobs.
Okay. Now, you have an aviation minute for us this week. What's the topic?
We're talking about the NTSB and the NTSB chairman, Debbie Herzman, who just resigned this last week. It hasn't taken effect yet, but it will soon. And so hopefully everybody will find that interesting.
Good. Also, in his Across the Pond segment, Peter Johnson, he records on the road this week, and he's going to bring us some news and stories from the European Space Agency, as well as he's going to suggest a few more aviation museums worth visiting in the UK. All right, and we'll finish up with some of the listener mail we received, but we better get started. We've got kind of a lot of stuff to talk about this episode, so let's get into the news. All right, to kick off our conversation on the news, we have an item from NPR, National Public Radio. This is there a better way to track aircraft during flight? Now, we've certainly heard in the news with regard to the Malaysian Flight 370 that the transponders, different communications devices were turned off in that flight, apparently. And people have been asking the question, how can we lose track of an airplane in this day and age? Shouldn't there be some way that we can do something different so that you don't lose a whole airplane? Rob, maybe you can sort of help us a little bit with the technologies that are in place here.
Well, the simplest one to track an airplane, I should say, is a transponder, which most people that are involved in aviation, even at the student pilot level, probably heard of, which is just simply a radio transmitter receiver that receives a signal from ground radar, and they basically talk up and back. And when the air traffic control radar sees transponder, it basically can tell them the speed and the altitude of the airplane, and it's probably the easiest one that everybody works with. There are newer technologies coming, ADS-B, that are not radar-based. Remember when we had Matt Desch from
Iridium.
Iridium. Thank you. From Iridium on a few months ago, he told us about the fact that all ADS-B really needs is a good receiver that the ADS-Bs on the airplanes can talk to. And, of course, they're going to put ADS-B receivers in all of the new satellite systems that the Iridium people are going to be starting to put up in 2015, I believe. And then, of course, there are a few more. There's ACARS and SatPhone and all that. But again, they require power, and they require they often require the antenna on the airplane to be focused. So sometimes when things go wrong or people start monkeying with things, the transmissions don't always get through. And that's kind of what we believe happened with the Malaysian flight, is that somebody turned off the gear.
Do you think it makes sense to, install something that can't be turned off? Is that, it's hard to make an argument for changing systems like this that are not inexpensive, sort of on the basis of just, one incident. But does it make sense to make this kind of bulletproof so you can't lose track?
Well, I think that's probably coming. To be honest, I thought it was coming after the Air France Airbus went into the South Atlantic, but it kind of disappeared after that. And the only thing that makes this, I should say that the recovery efforts certainly were very monumental on Air France 447, going down into the 12,000-13,000 foot water in the South Atlantic to recover the fuselage and the black boxes and all that. But that was actually, by comparison, easy because we knew where it was.
All right.
And even within 5 days of the accident, we were already finding debris on the surface because the airplane was fairly closely aligned with the flight path it was intended to take. In this case, not even close. And from the theories we've seen floating around, no pun intended, this airplane could be practically anywhere.
Yeah, it's as we record this, we have no information about where the aircraft is. And that may change by the time you all are listening to this. But as we record now, we don't know. Rob, you had an interesting post in Jetwine titled Malaysian Flight 370, A Great Show of Smoke and Mirrors. And this is, do you ever recall anything remotely similar to this kind of situation before?
No. And I started in on that a week ago Friday, when the Fox News people called me and asked me what I could tell them about the Malaysian airplane that had gone missing. And, of course, I said, what Malaysian airplane that had gone missing? I mean, because they called very quickly after that, and I had not even heard much about it. And so it seemed like it was going to be a fairly straightforward aircraft went down in the water. But over the course of the 10 days, what has just frustrated everyone no end, and certainly not just me, but officials, safety people from I don't know how many different countries, is that the story that comes out of Malaysia keeps changing. And it doesn't seem as though much of what we're hearing is based in fact. So even today, I was doing Sean Hannity's show just before we came in here to do this, and he and I were having a bit of a debate about the authenticity of the facts. And he said, how many are authentic? And I said, you know, essentially, I don't know anything they've said that's actually panned out because it's a proven fact. It's almost all been supposition. And I think that was kind of the point of the story was the Malaysians were obviously in way over their heads, and whether it's saving face or something else, but they really didn't want too much help, and it just made things very, very difficult. But of course, there's also an awful lot of information going on underneath the surface in the worldwide security world that we wouldn't be privy to anyhow. But this story is going to be around for a long time.
Yeah, it sure feels that way. In other aviation accidents or incidents that we've talked about in the past, there's always been, I think, sort of a progression of facts. You know, we'd have a few facts, and of course, many people would speculate based on those few facts, and then we get some more facts, and then there would be modified speculation. And, you know, it's always been quite some time before a good assessment, a good investigation by the proper people has brought out the real causes for what we observed. And in this case, it's different. Like you say, Rob, the facts keep changing, and what was a fact yesterday is not a fact today. So it leads to some crazy speculations, and we've talked about that.
Well, sure, and I think that for people that don't follow these kinds of investigations real closely, a very good example was when they lost the transponder and communication with the airplane initially, 1.5 hours, I think, after takeoff from Kuala Lumpur. And then the next day, there was speculation from the Malaysian defense minister that the airplane had turned. It had made a sharp turn and gone in another direction. And, of course, the first thing I said is, oh, that's interesting. How do you know that? Well, because the Malaysian government said it did. And I said, well, if you didn't have anything to track it with, if you lost all the data, and the radar is not very good in that area, how do you know that? Well, because the Malaysian government said it is. and it's amazing how much of the last 10 days has been because the Malaysian government said that. And it's been kind of crazy because look at how many different search locations have they had. First, it was the South China Sea, and then they focused more tightly on the Gulf of Thailand, and then to the Straits of Malacca on the west side of Malaysia. And then they went up towards India in the Bay of Bengal. And then they said, unless, of course, it went the other way, which was south. But we really don't know that either. So, I mean, I just feel bad for anybody. I guess I have this horrible picture in my mind that maybe the airplane went down in the water and there are all these people in rafts out there hoping that they're going to be rescued. But no one knows where they are. Mm-hmm. And that's why there have been so many associations to the TV series Lost.
Yes, I've had lots of references to that. Henry, everywhere I go, I run across people who are talking about this flight. And in the grocery store, you know, in the mall, I mean, you just walk past people and folks are talking about it. It kind of begs the question, what do you think this is going to do to the travel industry? Are people going to freak out over this and change their patterns? Or what do you think the effect is on the public?
Well, what's interesting is I heard from a friend who's a pilot for a big airline that flies 777s that when two passengers got on his flight, and I'm being purposely vague here to protect him and his airline, they freaked out. Then they insisted on getting off the airplane, even though it was a U.S. carrier, and they asked to be put on another flight that was not a 777. Likewise, I was on a flight myself last week when a passenger asked what kind of plane we were on, and the flight attendant replied 757, and the passenger replied, "Glad I'm not on a 777. So, you know, I think that for the casual traveler, not probably the person listening to this podcast, but for some casual travelers, they are, I think, afraid or at least a little bit concerned of the airplane. And I think that's unfortunate because at this point, we don't know. As Robert said, we don't really know what has happened. But bigger picture, I think this is going to be a terrible problem for Malaysia Airlines and for Malaysia. Malaysia Airlines was already under a lot of stress. You may recall that they announced that they would be ending their flights to the United States this year, that they were scaling back some of their other operations because they were not making money. Their CEO was already under a lot of pressure to turn the airline around and had been struggling to do that. You know, this man is not going to be leading should be leading Malaysia Airlines once they find the airplane and can get through this situation. And I think, frankly, this is going to create a problem for Malaysia as a destination for tourists because we don't know what has happened to the plane. We don't know if this is a result of a lapse in security at the airport or with the airline. And I think while these effects will be short term, they may last for a period of several months or more. That's, again, yet another reason why we need to find the aircraft, determine what happened, so that the airport can figure out what steps it needs to take and Malaysia Airlines can figure out what steps it needs to take, and Malaysia itself can recover so that it once again becomes an attractive tourist destination and place for business investment.
Yeah, I imagine the economic impact to Malaysia is, the country is likely to be significant. There are, you know, some aspects that maybe transcend just Malaysia Airlines or Malaysia, the country, with regard to security. And we saw how we apparently had some passengers aboard that plane with stolen passports, and that may or may not have anything to do with what happened to the flight after that. But do you think that some people will look at that and say, look, we need to get some better screening in place uniformly across the world to look for things like that?
Absolutely. From my standpoint, I think that it's critical that the passenger data be run against the same standards of detail as is run for travelers heading to or from the United States. I'm shocked, frankly, that we don't have a uniform standard. And let's just hope that it was not a result of a security lapse or these people with stolen passports that are the cause of this aircraft's disappearance.
And I think that's a really important point that Henry made, because just within 24 hours of this disappearance came that first note that two of the people had gotten on the airplane with stolen passports. And so do they need better security? Well, I don't know. I mean, the Interpol database supposedly has 30 or 40 million records in it of stolen passports around the world, and it doesn't do much good if nobody looks at it. And apparently that is pretty common, not just to Malaysian Airlines, but to a lot of carriers that just, for some reason, I don't know why, they just don't check it. And that certainly would have tipped them off to the fact that these two passports were stolen. Would that have affected this? We don't know. But all we know is we start adding up the security breaches, like not paying attention to the Interpol database. The first officer who had a history of, being friendly and letting people come up to the cockpit during flight. And they may be absolutely unrelated someday, then we find out. Or we might find out that we were being tipped off and everybody missed it.
Rob, our, let's say, guests in the cockpit, is that up to the individual regulatory authorities, or is there a global restriction against that kind of activity?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't know that there is a... I was trying to think. I'd have to go look at the 121 regs, because most of the airlines in the states that have reinforced cockpit doors are Part 121 carriers. And I have not looked at that since those doors were put in. But I know certainly that all the major airlines have regulations that are company operating procedures that will not allow them to bring anybody up into the cockpit. And in this case, we saw, I don't know, when was it? The airplane disappeared Saturday morning. I think by Monday morning, they were running these video interviews with a couple of, I don't know if they were Australian girls or New Zealanders or what, that had ridden up in the cockpit of one of Malaysia's A3 Airbuses, or I'm sorry, perhaps it was a 777, but and talked about the pictures they took and how friendly the crew was, and everybody in the West, I mean, the United States and Canada and Western Europe, are just aghast at this. But security is not the same everywhere as it is over here.
Rob, as everyone has been kind of glued to the television set trying to follow this, I've seen the news organizations, some have been better than others, some of the commentators, newscasters have been better than others in terms of covering this well. And maybe I can put you on the spot a little bit and just say, and just ask you, what's been your assessment of the quality, let's say, of the news reporting on this incident?
Well, for people that know me, I live in one of the suburbs just north of Chicago, up where Northwestern University is, which is a pretty blue town, and a pretty next to a pretty blue city, and in a pretty blue portion of the state. And when I heard Sean Hannity say, you have to admit that for the last week or 10 days, for a bunch of people that don't really have a whole lot of facts at their hands, all the media have done a really impressive job of keeping the story rolling. And I don't think he was picking on any one particular outlet. I think it was everybody. And I just shook my head and went, yeah, you're right. Because it is part of the problem that we have so much airtime to fill. Radio, TV, then there are these crazy bloggers out there and all these other people that think they have an opinion. And there's just so much content that's being developed. And they just try to keep the story going. And each time it's a little bit different, But in this case, almost none of it is based on fact.
But they keep talking.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah. That's why I tweeted earlier in the week. My new theory is it's a black hole somewhere over the because I've lost hours of my life that I can't get back watching all of the coverage.
All right. Any other comments on this before we move on?
No, I think that the story's not over by any stretch of the imagination. There are over 230 people that are unaccounted for. And I think what really has people frightened is, why did they take this airplane? If it didn't crash, if it's not in the ocean somewhere, and it's not really a new episode of Lost, what did they want this airplane for? And why did they want an airplane full of people? Certainly, there are easier ways to steal airplanes without taking one from a major city. And that's the part that's really frightening. We just don't know yet.
Right, yeah. You can imagine some scenarios that might explain something like that, but they're not very pleasant scenarios. Okay, let's move on to a story. This is from BreakingDefense.com. Saying goodbye to the hog, why Congress may let the U.S. Air Force retire the A-10. So, David, the hog, that's the warthog.
That's a warthog, where conveniently for a while they're conveniently located next to both of us in Bradley, Connecticut and Willow Grove. Mm. It's time to put the baby to bed. There's a lot of people who will disagree with me, and it's the greatest close air support aircraft of all time. But you know what? It's long in the tooth and very expensive to keep flying. And I think this time the Air Force is going to win. They've been trying to retire them since the early 90s.
So, David, why does Congress, or why has Congress kept it alive so long? When you have an Air Force that says, you know, we don't need this, or we don't want this, or we want something else, what's the thought process that says Congress can make them keep flying an aircraft?
It's called constituents. In this day and age, you do not want to lose your Air National Guard unit. You have employees and you have revenue, and a military base, even if it's adjacent to a civilian airfield, is still a revenue tax. You know, there are people who work there. They pay taxes to the local economy, and you don't want to lose that. I mean, that's one of the big deals in Horsham Township by me right now, is they lost the base. They wanted it closed, but now they realize, oh, wait a minute, we've lost all of the revenue that all these people working there had. So in this case, the Air Force has not said we're just eliminating them. They're doing things like the Maryland Air National Guard, who flies them outside of Baltimore, will be getting C-130Js. So the unit will transition into something else. And that base and that unit and those employees and those taxpayers will, that state will keep that revenue. I mean, it's just pure economics.
Now, the A-10, is that what you call close air support?
Close air support, yep. The A-10 was designed to blow up tanks. It was designed to fight a war in Germany where we had overwhelming odds of Russian tanks coming in to take Eastern Europe in the Cold War. And the A-10 was designed to blow up those tanks. One of the reasons why it was never exported was because its primary weapon is something called a 30-millimeter depleted uranium shell. And you can't provide depleted uranium shells to a lot of, it wasn't being able to be exported. So it was a aircraft purposely designed. It has a titanium bathtub for the cockpit where the pilot sits, and that's able to take huge amounts of damage. The whole aircraft was designed to fly low, slow, blow up things, and get the pilot back home. But in this day and age, it's kind of an anachronism, even though anybody on the ground who hears the whir of a A-10, because those are airline engines, it does its job really well. But unfortunately, it's time the the several hundred we have left need to go, and maybe they'll end up in museums, and or maybe they'll end up doing things like the California Fire wants, which is to convert them into single seat fire bombers, which would be really interesting. Yeah, that's been one of the proposed things. It's got the ability to carry a lot of retardant and stuff, and it's very maneuverable to fly in and out of canyons. So it would be a very good for that mission. So maybe A-10s will live on, but right now I think it's time, folks. As much as I love the airplane, it's time for it to go.
All right, interesting. That's almost an airplane of the week.
Yeah, I thought about doing it as an airplane of the week, but I'd end up writing like 2,000 words instead of 1,000, which is going to be twice as long.
Hey, right. David, remember when we saw those A-10s at Udvar-Hazy a couple of years ago when they – that was not last year, obviously. It must have been the year before. And what were those shells? Remember, you were showing me those shells in the nose that looked like they were about 10 inches long.
The A-10 was designed around a 30-millimeter Gatling gun. One of my all-time favorite pictures is it's bigger than a VW Bug. Now, the 70s version, not the modern one. But you're talking about an aircraft that was designed completely around a gun. And that shell, that 30-millimeter shell, is what it fires. And the tip of it is what they call depleted uranium, which becomes extremely hard to penetrate into the tank and then explode. So you're detonating inside of the armor, not on the outside.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing.
So inside a tank is not a good place to be with those around.
No.
No.
All right, one last news item. And Rob, you brought this in from Flight Global. Cessna and Beech unite as $4.6 billion Textron aviation segment.
I resent that remark.
I was just going to say, I didn't bring that.
You didn't bring that in?
No, David.
David brought
did.
That in?
Yeah.
Boy, David, you really have transformed from a purely military guy to an all-around airplane geek.
He's not just another pretty face.
I like airplanes. I don't know why everybody thinks that I like only military airplanes. I like airplanes.
So what's going on here with Cessna and Beech?
Well, Textron owns them both now, and it looks like, according to our friend of the show, Mr. Trimble, that they're going to lose the names and become Textron Aviation. So we're going to say goodbye to two of the greatest aviation companies in the world.
So the organizational name changes, I guess. Do the aircraft names change as well?
That's the part I wasn't clear on.
I wasn't clear on that either. My personal opinion is I hope it's sort of like Textron Aviation is like GM, but they'll still have Cessna and they'll still have Beechcraft. But there really was an undertone, and the fact that Stephen mentions that Bell Helicopter doesn't seem to be losing its name. I get the impression that Textron Aviation is going to be what it is going forward.
This is Henry, and I just have to say that, again, it's one thing if they want to create a corporate parent under Textron Aviation, that's fine. But to lose brands like Beech and Cessna would be flat out foolish. I mean, there is, I'm sure, on the books of both divisions, both companies, goodwill associated with the brand name. There's equity in those names. If they were to wipe those out and make all the airplanes Textron, that's very short-sighted.
Yeah, I agree with you, Henry. Unless there's some really compelling business reason to lose the Cessna and Beech brand names, they'd be nuts to do that.
I mean, they're historic. They're part of the fabric of history of the industry. They each produce good products, different types of products. And I think it would be a shame to lose those. And I think it would be a very, very short-sighted business decision.
So before everybody jumps down our throats, this actually just happened today on the 17th of of March 2014. So it's breaking news. So I'm sure we're going to hear more about it as the time goes on. But I don't want everybody to say, well, that's not what they said. Well, we have a small story that broke today. So that's, but it is historically, and as Henry said, it would be devastating to lose two of the greatest companies of all time in aviation.
It would be interesting to see what Cessna's response is when you say, well, why are you changing the names? I'd just like to hear their rationale for it.
Yes, I've seen this sort of thing sometimes in the past where you have a corporate entity, which is one group, and then you have different divisions which have strong brand names and are used to living in a world where that's the brand name. And sometimes the corporate guys can look at it from the standpoint of, well, we need to give one single corporate kind of brand identity to everything we do. And in my opinion, that usually doesn't work very well, especially with such long established brands.
Well, and they didn't drag Bell in there. Notice that. They left Bell Helicopters out of the mix.
Well, that's the really scary part was Stephen did mention that Bell seems to be keeping its name. So, and they've been a Textron company longer than everybody else. So, well, I guess we're going to just have to keep an eye on this.
All right. Well, thank you, David, for bringing that to us. And sorry for assuming that it came from our GA guy, Rob.
Well, he's not a GA guy. He talks about airliners all week long. and specifically missing airlines.
That's
so
right.
I'm trying to do the impression of Fox being fair and balanced to all of our segment listeners.
All right. Thanks, David. All right, let's now talk with Henry Hartevelt some more about some specific things that he's been involved in. Henry, we'd like to start off with this report. Now, I haven't read the report, but the title of the report, the research, I find fascinating. It's Your Most Probable Customer in 2020 to 2040, Today's 18 to 23-Year-Old Traveler.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of times we tend to sort of ignore the younger segment of any market because in many cases they're not where most of the revenue comes from. Tell us about this research.
Sure. So thanks. This is a report that I wrote last year for Hudson Crossing and is available for sale on the Hudson Crossing website. The 18 to 23-year-old market represents a group of people of more than 20 million in size. They are obviously a group with a lifetime of travel ahead of them. They are, suffice to say, technology focused. They are device rich. For example, almost half own a tablet device and 77% own a smartphone. Compare that to about 40% of all travelers and two-thirds of all travelers, respectively. They are very individualistic. They seek very different kinds of experiences when they travel. They are already starting to engage in airline loyalty programs. 55% engage in airline loyalty programs. But this is an audience that views travel and the travel landscape very, very differently. They have grown up looking at the world through the internet, going halfway around the world to watch their favorite rock group perform is not something that they would be fazed by. It's simply a matter of do they have the money to do it? And many of them will just put it on a credit card and figure out how to pay for it later. And at the same time, they are very careful about how they spend their money because the 2008-2009 recession is very fresh in their mind. For some, they saw their parents lose jobs. Some themselves may have lost their jobs. So they're going to be a very, very different kind of spender going forward. And then finally, this is an audience for whom the airline landscape will be defined by new generation carriers such as JetBlue and Virgin America rather than legacy airlines like United or American. They look at the world differently.
So how should airlines and how should the travel industry in general react to that fact?
Well, you know, understand this. This is not a stupid audience, and this is not just a bunch of doped up college kids.
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh. I'm just thinking about my college. No, never mind.
Yeah. Don't ask, don't tell. Right, anyway, I think the thing to understand about this audience compared to Generation X, compared to baby boomers and so on, is first, they are very, very individualistic. So the a la carte model for airline travel is actually something this group would like. You know, this is a generation that has, you know, created their own playlists by buying the songs they want, not just the albums they want online. They pick the exact kind of coffees or whatever they wish to brew through their coffee making machines like Keurigs. They have forced the fast food industry to let them customize their orders and so on. So they want what they want, and the airlines are going to have to respond by empowering them to tailor their flights or vacation packages, whatever it may be. Authenticity is important. They want to understand what they're buying in great clarity. You know, they are indeed very careful spenders. They want good value. They will spend. They will travel last minute. But they want to understand the value they're getting beyond just the price they are paying. So, for example, details like, do you have power in the seats? What's your on-time record? Other elements will be important. And then just because they join your loyalty program doesn't mean they will be loyal to you. They will not view the airline as their spouse or partner. Rather than they will look at the airline as one of several friends in the group. And they may rule out some carriers, but each purchase transaction will likely be a case-by-case basis, unless an airline, of course, really dominates their hometown. One thing that, if I can, I just found really interesting about this group, they are the most dissatisfied with online travel planning, and they are the most likely to want to use a travel agent, a traditional travel agent, to help them plan and book their trips.
I guess, Henry, that actually is a good dovetail to my question is, how do they view customer service? Is it a driver, or is it there's an expectation, or they're in a set point where they know that it's going to be a one-time transaction, so they understand that they might not get the best service, or are they looking out for that?
They do pay attention to customer service. So, for example, they're very happy to serve themselves through electronic means, digital means, you know, mobile check-in, for example, kiosks, whatever. But if things go wrong, they want someone who's available and who will help them. They probably have grown up with parents, at least one parent who's belonged to a frequent flyer program. They may understand that they are traveling in a get-you-get-what-you-pay-for kind of world. But what they will say is, well, if I need help, I expect to be able to get it. And this group especially will turn to social media, namely Twitter, and expect to be able to get some form of assistance or response through social media. Again, most likely Twitter. So you look at airlines such as American and Delta and JetBlue and Virgin America, KLM, among others, that have done an exemplary job of using Twitter as not only a marketing channel, but also as a customer support and service channel. And, that's going to be very important.
Rob, Henry's making me feel kind of old.
Sorry. No, I'm the one who wrote the report, and how do you think I felt writing
this? Yes.
I really wanted to subtitle this thing, or how I felt bitter, writing about a new generation of travelers. But it is what is amazing to me, as someone who's done marketing for all of my career, is the 18 to 23-year-old customer is going to grow up and be very, very different, because some of these attitudes, some of these mindsets, they're not going to change as they grow up. They may go to work for companies that say you have a choice of carriers A, B, or C when you fly. They may not accept that. They will push back and they will say, but why can't we fly airline D if that's what we think gives us the best value, if that's what helps us save money, if that's what has better entertainment on board. This is a very product-focused customer. Remember, they line up, by the hundreds to be among the first to buy the new latest Apple product, which is a premium-priced product, because it's an experience. They will not accept the status quo. And I think more so than any generation since the baby boomers, the 18 to 23s will redefine how many industries, airlines and travel companies among them, have to do business.
So responding to this, it seems to me, on the part of the airlines, is kind of an investment they may need to make for their own future.
Absolutely. Airlines are going to have to look at things like, what are their frequent flyer programs? What is the value proposition? How do they market? Advertising alone won't cut it, although this is an audience that certainly does pay attention to advertising. What's the corporate social responsibility? Is the airline buying and operating new generation aircraft? What are its hiring policies and so on? The 18 to 23-year-old customer is a very nice person. They are a very thoughtful person. They are very focused on the larger world around them. They want to make sure that the brands they choose, again, whether it's an airline or a coffee company, reflect their own values. They see brands as a reflection of who they are.
Henry, do you see any other trends in the travel industry with respect to airlines especially?
Well, there are a couple of things. We may have discussed this in the past, but certainly the nature of alliances is changing. We are seeing airlines really favor their joint venture partners or other partnerships that may reflect an investment stake that one company has in another. We are seeing some airlines that are not happy with some of their partners take steps to make themselves happy, which may mean distancing themselves from a previous partner and competing head on against them. I'm thinking about what Delta Airlines and Alaska Airlines are doing right now in Seattle. And, I'm looking at companies like Etihad and Delta, which are making investments in other airlines, small stakes, but nonetheless investments, creating these partnerships in very different ways than we used to see a few years ago. So that makes me question, what's the future of the airline alliance? Will the U.S. carriers participate to the same degree going forward as they have in the past? And what does it mean for other airlines in the world? And then the last big thing I'm looking at is mobile. For anyone who followed the South by Southwest Interactive Tech Fest a few weeks ago, so much was about mobile and wearables and so on. And I think that these have an ability to change how airlines do business, how they serve customers, how they work with customers, even their own internal operations. And I think that's going to be a major, major trend to watch in the airline industry, because it's not just a customer-focusing channel, but imagine what would happen if an airline's MRO team was equipped with wearables such as a Google Glass device or a smartwatch or something else like that.
That's really fascinating. How do you think those kinds of transitions are made? I mean, is it a matter of one company kind of gets it when all the others don't, and so implements these kinds of technologies, and the others wake up and say, oh, gee, I guess that was a good idea? Or is there some other forcing function?
I think airlines are going to be the followers here. They may look to see, do military or do air forces start to use this, or car companies, car manufacturers, even the local car dealership in the car shop, in the repair shop, are they doing some of this? Airlines tend to be followers. In this case, it's a question of will they be a fast follower or lag a little bit more. We're seeing Virgin Atlantic test where a Google Glass at Heathrow Airport with its upper class business class customers and check-in, and it's Heathrow Airport Lounge. We're seeing a few other initiatives around this. Disney is doing something at its theme parks with an RFID chip wristband. So I think airlines are going to look at all of these different things and figure out where to go. And it's not even going to be crawl, walk, run. It's going to be take a little toe and dip it out there and then come back and then maybe take another toe and so on. And, you know, it's going to be very, very cautious because the airlines want to figure out, and I think they're right to, what's going to be real, what's going to make sense, what will people feel comfortable with, because the pace of change in technology, as we all know, is so rapid. They just want to make sure that they catch the tide rather than getting too far ahead of it.
Hmm. Yeah, when I saw the item about the Google Glass in the upper class lounge there, as I recall, the motivation was so that as the sort of premium flyers, the premium customers arrived in the lounge, the employees, the airline employees there could have something come up in their, you know, their sort of their heads up, their Google Glass display that would identify who the traveler was, provide information about what their flight was, any other kind of personal information, things that would sort of personalize the interaction and the experience between the airline employee and the flyer. Fascinating
and
stuff.
You know what? That's fascinating and it's really nice, but A, you've got to be very careful. There's a line out there between cool and creepy.
Yeah, I was going to say that was starting to become creepy on my part. One of my creepiest things I ever saw on sci-fi was, I forget which Tom Cruise movie it is, where he's walking down the hallway in a shopping mall, and because of his eyes, the walls are changing into ads personalized to him. And that was just sort of like, that's getting awfully close.
Minority Report, if I'm remembering correctly.
Right, but that's getting pretty close to that kind of personalization. I mean, look at what ads show up on Facebook that are personalized for you. But that's just, having someone walk in with a Google Glass, you walk into a lounge and they go, "Hi, Mr. Vanderhoof, how are you? Would you like your martini dry today?" It's like, no, it's kind of...
Yeah. And David, I'm with you on that. I think that, you know, there are places where some of these wearables will be additive to the experience and some where they are unnecessary. I would say that it's great. Virgin Atlantic is trying it. They're getting tons of PR. But as the customer, when you walk into that lounge, all you want them to do is say, "Hello, welcome. Bar's over here. Food buffet is over there. Business center is this way. Have a nice time." You want it to be quick, you want it to be focused, and you want to be on your way. So the big issue is, where do things like wearables fit in? And there may be places where they don't fit in with the airline, and there may be places where they do. What's also just been interesting is just watching reaction to them, because Google Glass does have the ability to tape record and video. There was a passenger wearing Google Glass on a flight that I took last week, again, on purposely leaving the airline en route out. And passengers objected to it. The airline check-in agent at the gate objected to it. The flight attendants objected to it. And the pilots objected to it. And they asked the passenger very nicely to take off his Google Glass. And he refused. And it came down to a situation where they asked him, "Please take those off and do not wear them while you're on the plane, or we'll refund your money and we'll ask you to take a different airline."
Wow.
And, you know, again, I think they were right to do this. You want to have control over your environment. Wearables can be great. I think smartwatches are great. I think Google Glass can be wonderful as a user for wayfinding at an airport, getting offers from nearby merchants, and so on. But there are boundaries that have to be respected in terms of what you do and how you use them. And we're still learning about this. But I think the potential is there. Research that I've done shows 37% of leisure travelers and 52% of business travelers see value potentially for wearables when they travel. So, you know, airlines are going to have to get used to this. We are going to start to see more and more people show up with it. we're going to have to, airlines are going to have to figure out what are the rules, what are the procedures, what are the policies passengers will need to abide by when using a device like a Google Glass or anything else like that.
Interesting stuff. The world keeps changing.
It does.
It does.
Except on Mad Men, where it's going to be 1968 and TWA.
Forever. All right. Henry, is there some place online where folks can follow you or find out more about the things that you're doing?
Thanks. Well, if they go to hudsoncrossing.com and then click on the research reports section, they'll find all the reports that I've written for Hudson Crossing over the last year, and they're all available for sale.
Very good. Thanks, thanks, Henry, for joining us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
I think he gets his green jacket this time.
I know. You've been on a bunch of – how many times have you been on? Three or four or something?
I don't know. It's a pleasure. I enjoy it, and I thank you for coming back and asking me to come back on here. So thank you.
Oh, and we'll do it again for sure.
Thanks for coming, Henry. Oh, you know, I was going to ask you, though. I was listening to the concept of the Google Glass thing. I'm not quite sure if I understood what the objection was by the crews with the guy wearing or the person wearing the Google Glass.
The objection is that Google Glass has the ability to video recording. And passengers were concerned. Were they being recorded? The crew, the agent was concerned. Was she being recorded? And the crew was concerned. Were they being recorded, or were airline safety procedures being recorded? And unfortunately, it doesn't appear that there's a way to a visual indicator to let you know is the glass being used in record mode.
That's really because I was on tour at the Smithsonian with a guy with it, and there's no way of you knowing he's recording.
Right.
There's no blinking. You know. There's no. It's not like an old camera where there's a blinking red light showing you're recording.
Right. It's, I was just going to say recording. It's not like when you're at a TV studio and the red light's atop the camera that's on or anything else.
And I think Google eventually is going to have to acknowledge that that's going to have to be a fact.
Yes, I agree. I mean, and to its credit, look, Google is a company that is very focused on testing new products and iterating. So no doubt they are learning a lot about not just the technical performance, but the emotional reaction to Google Glass as their users are wearing them and reporting back.
Yeah, it's almost as much a social experiment as it is a new technology.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, again, you talk about Brave New World. This is really a Brave New World, and it is a completely new dimension in what we know and understand about mobile. And I think, again, it will have profound impact on airlines, on airports, and the broader travel industry, hotels and others. I mean, you think about this, there's a lot of exciting potential here. There's also a lot that we need to make sure that we think of, again, you know, from the standpoint of those who could or would do harm, whether it's, you know, a hijacker. How do families with small children feel about being around the folks wearing these devices and so on? There's a lot we don't understand, and we're all going to have to try to figure this out.
Yep, absolutely. All right, Henry, thanks again.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Henry.
Bye. Thank you, David. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Max.
And now here's Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association to tell us what to expect in the next NBAA Flight Plan podcast.
Gentlemen, this week on NBAA's Flight Plan podcast, we're talking about people who aren't flying, at least, you know, for a short period of time. There's a growing trend, you see, toward regional safety stand-downs, and that's a good thing. NBAA's Flight Plan. You'll find it at the home of the National Business Aviation Association, NBAA.org.
All right, and now with his airplane of the week, here's David Vanderhoof, our official airplane geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. The Airplane Geeks Airplane of the Week, going GA, the Cessna 150. okay, last week I admit I went pretty obscure. This week I thought we needed some GA appeal. So from a production run of 6 aircraft, the SH-5, to a production run of 23,839 over 20 years. In the mid-1950s, Cessna began designing a replacement for its C-140. One of the first requirements of this aircraft was it was to have tricycle landing gear. As a trainer, it was understood that a tricycle landing gear was easier to learn on than a conventional or tailwheel. The C-140's rounded wingtips and control surfaces were squared off to fit a more modern profile. The wing also had hinged flaps replaced with Fowlers. For those who don't know, a plane or hinge flap just drops down from the rear of the wing. A Fowler or Fowler, I don't know which is the proper pronunciation, maybe Rob can help me, flap slides back first, increasing the wing area, and then downward to provide better lift. The Cessna 140 ended production with the Cessna 150s rolling out, taking to the air on the first time on September 12, 1957. The original 150 was a high-wing monoplane, the high wing supported by two diagonal struts. The wing is aluminum with a 40-degree paralift flaps. The engine choice was the Continental 0200A engine. The 0200A generated 100 horsepower and had a 26-gallon fuel tank. It was on the market in three versions, the Standard, the Trainer, and the Commuter. The Standard was your stock aircraft. Upgrading to the Trainer got you amenities like a dual yoke, a clock, sun visors, an outside temperature gauge, turn and bank indicators, and wait for it, a cigarette lighter. The Commuter replaced the Narco Super Homer VOR with 9 quartz crystals with a vacuum tube system. Oh, and for that additional speed and flare, optional wheel spats. All of this could be yours delivered for $8,795. Adjusted for inflation, folks, that's equivalent to $70,700 in 2014 dollars. The following year, the 150 added the Patroller. With a 38-gallon fuel tank, plexiglass doors for observations, and a chute in the floor for dropping flares or messages. In 1961, again, more improvements were made. The small rear windows were increased by 15%, and the aft landing gear was moved back 2 inches. A two-place baggage shelf was made available for the Commuter with a removable section for a child seat. In 1962, the 150B was introduced. A new contoured wing, pointier spinner, and a new propeller increased the speed by 3 miles an hour. The service ceiling also rose by 300 feet to a total of 15,600 feet. Lastly, the Commuter introduced the Cessna ARC Navomatic Autopilot. I love 50s marketing. Incremental changes went out the window in 1964 with the 150D. The 150D introduced the OmniVision, more of that marketing, rear window. The window cost the 150D a speed reduction of 3 miles per hour. It did create the ability to carry 120 pounds of luggage instead of the previous 80 pounds. In the marketing universe, the 150D came with a 12 exterior colors, with the interior colors going from 2 to 4. The following year, the 150E added bucket seats instead of the bench and a rear view mirror on the dash. In 1966 was a major model year change, the 150F. The original vertical stabilizer was swept back to 35 degrees. This was matched the styling of its bigger brother, the 172. The doors were made 23% wider to allow people like me to be able to get in. The 150F also introduced electrically operated flaps. Gone were the manuals. The change in the stabilizer also allowed a 50% increase in the baggage compartment. The F was also the first license-built 150 and built by Reims in France. The 150G through J had small modifications to the instrumentation. The J introduced the key starter instead of the pull starter. And according to some sources, it worked worse than the pull. In 1970 was the 150K, or the A150K Aerobat. While the Aerobat kept the 100 horsepower 0200, the fuselage and wing were strengthened to a plus 6 minus 3G. It also added skylights and added four-point harnesses for the occupants. Removable cushions so parachutes could, and jettison doors were also added as safety precautions.
From 1971 to 1974, the 150L was in production. The landing gear width was increased by a foot from 7 feet 7 inches. The spring steel was replaced by tubular legs. To increase visibility, the taxi lights were moved under the engine. What was an improvement in visibility created a shorter bulb life. Due to heat and vibrations, the lights were moved back to the wing. Also, the straight line of tail was lengthened to reach the window for aesthetics. The M was the last major version introduced in 1975. It was 6 inches taller and featured higher-end electronics and avionics. Production of the 150 ended in April of 1977. Jeanette Schoenberg flew a 150F Gulf Alpha Whiskey in the summer of 1980 from London, England to Darwin, Australia to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Amy Johnson's flight. Alpha Whiskey is being restored by the Cessna 150-152 Club. 150s have been used to win the National Intercollegiate Flying Association National Championships. Emory Riddle, the University of North Dakota, and the United States Air Force Academy have won, all with 150s of various types. The United States Air Force, the 150 is designated the T-51. And due to the altitude of the Academy, they are replaced with 150-horsepower Lycoming L320 E2Ds. They've been replaced currently by T-53s, otherwise known as the show's favorite civilian aircraft, the SR-22 Cirrus. It's a primary trainer for other small air forces, such as Burundi, Congo, Ecuador, Haiti, Ivory Coast, Liberia, the Mexican Navy, the Paraguayan Navy, Somalia, and Sri Lanka. Interesting enough that an aircraft that was designed not to be a tail dragger can be one with aftermarket conversion kits. Also, there are stall kits available with vortex generators and with different wingtips to assist in bush flying, as well as float kits. The Cessna 150 was succeeded by the 152. Like I stated in the introduction, 23,949 were built over 20 years in three countries, Argentina, France, and the United States. And on that note, giving a little GA love, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Oh, David, nicely done.
Yeah.
Considering the fact that I've spent, I cannot tell you how much of my life in a 150. this was really fun. And for people that may be wondering, you can buy one. I was just looking at some prices here while I was listening to you, David. And you can pick up a nice used Cessna 150, a late model, 1977, for somewhere between $20,000 and $27,000, which is
wow,
a lot less than the price of a car these days.
Sure is.
5 gallons of gas an hour. Grant you, gas is a little expensive. But you can do an awful lot of flying when the airplane only costs that much to start with. And the one thing I was wondering whether you were going to zing into the 152s or not, because I had a couple of those the first year they came out, and I really they flew nice. They were just they had a different engine in them. They had a Lycoming in them, and they were just a son of a gun to start when it was cold. And so those of us that had a lot of time in 150s with Continentals, that you turn the key, it didn't matter how cold it was, you turn the key and it'd go boom, they'd start up. But the Lycomings, below 40 degrees, they were a nightmare.
The other interesting thing that I learned about was that Cessna has taken the Skycatcher out of production.
I thought didn't we mention that a couple of weeks ago? I thought we did. Maybe I heard it.
I was sort of surprised. So it was like, maybe it was just one of those things that we mentioned in passing, but it was sort of like, wow, that was a short-lived project.
Well, the guy from, Scott, well, you'll have to get me. I can't remember his last name, the CEO of Cessna, made it real clear that little airplanes were not his favorite anyway. So the Skycatcher was not long for the world.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 16th of March, 2014.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 291. Grant, we're back after a two-week, well, sort of break.
Yeah, well, yeah, we sort of had one a couple of weeks ago, but we totally missed last week. And it was mostly because we were wiped out after a very busy time shooting video and running around at the Tyre Bear Show.
I've got to tell you, mate, if you know anybody thinks that producing podcast material is hard work, try doing video. Good Lord. That's going to take us weeks to put that one together, but a lot of fun down there at the Tyre Bear Show last weekend here in Victoria. And, Grant, I actually noticed that they've changed that airport name to Mornington Peninsula Airport.
Oh, really? It's still going to be Tyab for me, mate.
Absolutely. If they call it anything else, then I'll never find the place.
Well, folks, if you want to see what could be coming up on the DVD that we're producing, and aside from Steve being lost, uncertain of position while trying to find it.
That's the one.
We've put out some teasers on our Facebook page. So keep up with our Facebook page at facebook.com/playingcrazydownunder and keep an eye on that DVD as it's coming along and get in the queue to buy it.
Absolutely. Hey, Grant, how many cameras did we have inside that Royal Australian Air Force FA-18?
Oh, the classic? Well, there were two GoPros in there, mate. One looking backwards over Wing Commander Tim Allsop's right shoulder. So you're getting his pretty much all of his body, is mostly and the right wing and so on, some of the outside world. And one looking forward over his left shoulder. And word is, I haven't got it confirmed, but I think we're getting the heads-up display, the hood camera as well. So that could be pretty good. All those shots would be great, especially the ones looking forward as he did that formation flight with the P-51.
Oh, outstanding. Okay, enough showing off. Grant, you know, we talk a lot about the woes going on in the Qantas group and maintenance winding back, but looks like things are happening here at another provider, John Holland Aviation Services. They've got a facility here at Melbourne's Tullamarine Airport, Melbourne International Airport, and it looks like they're closing that one down. And there's actually an interesting backstory to that.
This used to be the Ansett maintenance area, I believe. John Holland have been operating it for quite a while. They had Tiger, they had Virgin. They were doing quite a bit of work. They primarily at Tuller, but also operations at Adelaide, Perth, Sydney, Brisbane. But things have slipped away from them. They lost Tiger. They've lost the Virgin work, and they're sort of turning up their toes and winding up operations.
And it's saying here in a couple of articles that we're reading online that it, up to 230 jobs might be lost there. Now, it's interesting, Grant, that Tiger Air actually switched their maintenance over to BAE Systems, who set up a hangar on another part of the field just around the corner, actually, at Melbourne Airport. So be interesting to see what happens. And, of course, Virgin Australia's fleet, well, that's practically all maintained overseas, primarily, as we found over in New Zealand. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to this rather sizable maintenance facility once John Holland shut down, and maybe BAE Systems might expand and move in there. It'll be interesting to watch.
A lot of changes have happened recently out at Tuller. Jetstar are doing some of their A-checks, apparently, on their A320s in the area where they used to be the Qantas maintenance base, but it was allowed to get kind of quiet. Now it's being used for the 787 maintenance. All of Jetstar's 787s are being maintained here in Melbourne, such as it is. I think the pretty heavy stuff is probably going to be elsewhere, but they're doing maintenance there and also doing a few A320s in that same hangar. Then you've got John Holland, and that's sort of winding down now. And that lone hangar, actually the one where the Jetstar demonstrator, ZA-003, the test aircraft, that came through and parked when it did its last Australian tour. That was in front of the BAE Systems hangar.
Oh, of course, would you, Grant? I remember taking the bus ride. You know, nothing better than a bus ride through Melbourne International Airport. If you've got to take a bus ride anywhere, I reckon that's a good way to do it.
Yeah, the airside run, always a lot of fun.
We haven't seen a lot of focus on that in the media, really, and of course everything seems to be permanently focused on Qantas and all of their woes and what's happening with their maintenance. Grant, I noticed with interest, just talking about Qantas, that Alan Joyce and Gareth Evans and some of his senior managers being grilled during the week by a Senate committee, the debate over whether or not the Qantas Sale Act should be changed to allow greater amounts of foreign ownership in Qantas and a restructure of its ownership. You know, all that sort of stuff is being debated hotly in Parliament. I'm not so sure it's actually going to get through. But I'll tell you what, mate, I managed to sit down, just goes to show you how boring my life's been in the last couple of weeks. I managed to sit down and watch some of this Senate committee hearing on the television last week. And I'll tell you what, some of these senators, particularly independent senator from South Australia, Nick Xenophon, who we've had on the show before, really grilling Alan Joyce. Alan Joyce, I thought, well, he handled himself pretty well, although really a lot of spin, in my opinion. So it grinds on, mate. It certainly grinds on.
Oh, doesn't it just, mate? And yeah, you can always count on AJ for a bit of spin. But, you know, that, yeah, onwards and crazily with Qantas. Who knows where that's going to wind up? But I've got to say, even if they do repeal the Qantas Sale Act, it's not going to resolve the 49% limitation on foreign ownership. Any airline that flies internationally on behalf of Australia cannot be more than 49% owned by foreign entities, no matter which one. So removing the Qantas Sale Act will remove a number of limitations on Qantas. But until they restructure, similar to how Virgin did, so that on paper, they're two different companies doing international versus domestic, then they can have 100% foreign ownership in their domestic operations, as Virgin Australia have done for theirs and Tiger Airways do with theirs. So it's a lot of people are running around saying, oh, remove the Qantas Sale Act and then they can have full ownership. No, no. The Air Navigation Act gets in the way as well. So, yeah, while the Qantas Sale Act does need to go to help level things, Qantas have to change to take advantage of that. But Joyce keeps conveniently avoiding all of that and doesn't really have any answers when pushed on it.
You know, it's a constant narrative that the Qantas PR team, I guess, puts out there into the media, and the media seem to have swallowed it particularly well. And, of course, that's getting out into the public psyche to where most people are saying, now, well, yeah, we should change the act. But, you know, it seems to me that, as you pointed out there, Grant, I think a lot of people don't realise that it's not just such a simple exercise as changing that act. There's a lot more that would have to go with it.
The act encompasses a lot of areas, not just foreign ownership limits and things like that. But, yeah, I get a little upset whenever I hear Qantas saying, oh, we're the Australian airline. Yeah, we're the Australian airline that uses Kiwis to fly across the Tasman with Jet Connect. We base half our people with Jetstar over in Singapore to try and take advantage of their labour laws. Yeah, and... oh, also, we're closing down a whole lot of our maintenance facilities and sending them overseas. So, yeah, just how Australian are you guys?
Well, they do have a kangaroo on the tail of their aircraft, Grant.
Yeah, well, there's always that for now.
Absolutely.
Until Jetstar takes over.
Okay, let's stop talking about Qantas. It only makes me depressed, Grant. Let's talk about some exciting news on the military front. Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott announced this week in an interesting move that actually I think Grant said off air that he'd actually agree with, which is amazing if you know what Grant thinks of the Prime Minister, that Australia will be committing to the purchase of some MQ-4C Triton UAVs, UASs. What are they called?
Bloody big drones. No.
BBDs.
Yeah, although they haven't committed to exactly when and how many, they are going to go ahead with the purchase. They're definitely going to follow through. So they've declared the P-8A Poseidon recently. And in that announcement, they were saying there were going to be drones, but they hadn't locked in. Well, they've said that they're going to go for the MQ-4C Triton. And yeah, I guess we'll see in the near future just how many will be coming along and when we should expect them.
Yes, interesting, Grant. And of course, as would be tradition, I guess, with the Royal Australian Air Force, you know, the maritime surveillance aircraft, the AP3C Orions, and I guess their replacement aircraft will be based at RAF Base Edinburgh, which is in South Australia. And Grant, interesting that announcement was made out there at South Australia this week. Did you know there was an election there on the weekend, a state election? Coincidence,
yeah.
Do you think?
Yeah, funny how that is, isn't it? A state election where it looks like the ruling Federal Party may also get back in that state.
Geez, you've got to love politicians. It says here in this article that we're reading in australianaviation.com.au that neither the number of aircraft expected to be acquired under the Air 7000 Phase 1B project nor their planned introduction into service date were specified. But these details will be considered by the government in 2016 based on the outcome of the forthcoming defence white paper process, Mr. Abbott stated on Thursday. So, wow, you know, it's interesting. They would have to apparently invest about $140 million in new facilities and infrastructure, approximately $100 million of which will be invested in South Australia. So vote for us and we may buy these planes for you, I guess is the way I would read
that. No, we've committed to definitely consider it.
You know, Grant, I think one of us is way too cynical. Maybe both of us are.
I think both of us are, mate. I think both of us are. Look, I think it's great that they're going ahead and going to, you know, bams, baby, link it all together. But, yeah, I would really, 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 really like to see some stats on it. But, you know, yeah, they're going to commit to it. Yay! We don't know how many. We don't know when. Whatever.
Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
Yeah, and I'm Grant McCarran.
All right, thanks, guys. David, that MQ-4C, that's in the U.S., does a Navy mission?
And it's the naval version of the Global Hawk. The Navy grew the MQ. The Global Hawk is the MQ-4A or B. The MQ-4C is designed for the BAMS, or Broad Area Maritime Surveillance.
And it's a bigger wingspan. It's got a bigger payload capacity. And it is supposed to link up with the P-8 Poseidon, which was deployed by the United States Navy and the Indians to search for MH-370. So go back a couple episodes and listen to the P-8 segment, because they're the ones doing the lead in searching in the southern part of the search area.
All right, now it's time for Rob's Aviation Minute. Rob, do you want to kick this off?
Well, I don't know. I think we should probably just say that it's about our National Transportation Safety Board, which is one of the few government agencies that runs pretty darn nicely over here.
All right, here's Rob.
From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute. Just as the aviation world began spinning out of control last week over the disappearance of Malaysian Flight 370, came news that one of the industry's most respected safety advocates, NTSB Chairman Debbie Herzman, had turned in her resignation to a post she's held for a decade. That's irony. Besides building a reputation as a no-nonsense leader of this world-renowned safety agency, Herzman also made a few headlines herself over the years. Like when she mentioned that states should consider banning drivers from using any kind of electronic devices from behind the wheel. Then there was last summer's crash of an Asiana Airlines Boeing 777 in San Francisco. Within days, not the weeks or the months we're used to, Herzman began sharing selected facts of the case with the public. Not speculation, of course, because, as always, the NTSB's role is what happened, not why. But even just releasing facts, like portions of the Asiana crew's cockpit conversations, angered the Airline Pilots Association. Again, what irony that Deb Herzman's leaving, just when the NTSB is again being pointed out as the safety organization whose expertise could have been better used to help find the stolen Malaysian airliner. By treaty, of course, the U.S. and other participants must be invited to the investigation, and a few NTSB people are already in Malaysia, but apparently not enough to make much difference because the confusing details just keep dribbling out of Kuala Lumpur. But that's a story for another day. Right now, we can only hope that the White House takes the bold step of finding a suitable replacement for Chairman Herzman, someone with the same knack for telling the truth while avoiding the political foray. But honestly, I don't hold out a lot of hope. After all, it was Mr. Obama who placed a couple of political appointees in key transportation roles, like the DOT secretary and the FAA administrator. Now, you know what a true political appointee is, don't you? That's someone who does just what the White House tells them to, and nothing more. And that will never be Debbie Herzman's legacy at the NTSB. For the Aviation Minute, I'm Rob Mark in Chicago. See you next time.
All right, Rob, very good. I understand Herzman is going to be the president and CEO of the National Safety Council.
Yeah, she's coming out here to Chicago to be president of the or CEO of the National Safety Council. And so I wish I knew why she had left the NTSB. I heard lots of stories, and but I don't know how many of them are true, so we'll just pass on them. But it's really a shame because she really has done a wonderful job of not only getting the job done, but raising the visibility of the NTSB all over the world. And she's going to be a tough act to follow.
Yeah, I think of the word transparency. I know it's kind of a buzzword these days in government, but when I think of the NTSB these days, I think of that word.
Yeah, and we've had Bill English, of course, on the show a couple of times, and I found out that during all this media work I've been doing, someone that used to work at the NTSB went to the same graduate school that I did, and she said, "Oh, you ought to have some of the other NTSB people on." She said, "They are so cool." I said, "Well, we'll have to look into that."
Yeah, for sure. Now it's time for Peter Johnson across the pond.
Hi. Here's a few stories that caught my eye worth a mention. Starting with some space stories, it's certainly been a year for the joint European Space Agency and NASA spacecraft Cassini. Launched in 1997 and arriving to study Saturn in 2004, for the last 10 years it's been studying Saturn's main moon called Titan. It also carried and released a probe called Huygens, which landed successfully on Saturn's moon Titan in 2005. Built and operated by ESA, it became the first spacecraft ever to land on Titan. Huygens separated from the Cassini mothership on December 25th, 2004, and landed on Titan on the 14th of January 2005 near the Xanadu region. This was the first landing ever accomplished in the outer solar system. It did touch down on land, although there is the possibility it would touch down in an ocean, and this was also taken into account in its design. The probe was designed to gather data for a few hours in the atmosphere and a short time at the surface. It continued to send data for about 90 minutes after touchdown. It remains the most distant landing of any man-made craft. And the reason for that little bit of information is that earlier this month, Cassini completed its 100th flyby of Titan. Other highlights to look at later this year from ESA, of course, is Rosetta, the spacecraft due to arrive and orbit the comet 67P. That will be in August, and on November the 11th, it will hopefully land its probe, Philae, onto the comet. Before that, on September the 24th, India's first Mars orbiter will arrive at the planet, 2 days after the NASA spacecraft MAVEN. So far this year, in January and February, we've seen 14 rocket launches to space, 5 from the USA, 4 from Russia, 2 from ESA, 2 from Japan, and 1 from India. Sticking with space, preparations continue for UK astronaut Major Tim Peake's flight to the International Space Station next year. His training's increased and he's spending a lot of time either in the USA or in Russia in the pool preparing for any EVAs or the launch, which of course will be a Russian rocket. Now, if you're based in a European country, you have the chance to name Tim Peake's mission. I'll put a link in the show notes if you're feeling creative. Tim is, of course, the first British astronaut to join the European Space Corps, which he did in the 2009 class. Officially the first British astronaut, Helen Sharman was, in fact, the first Briton to go into space in 1991 on Project Juno, a cooperative project between a number of UK companies and the Soviet government. She spent a week in the Mir space station. However, the most experienced British-born astronaut is NASA's Michael Fole. He accumulated 374 days in orbit, completing long-duration missions to both the ISS and Mir. The European Space Agency's final automatic transfer vehicle, ATV, is now preparing to fly aboard an Ariane rocket from French Guiana on July the 25th. That's the target launch date. This is the last ESA ATV which takes supplies to the ISS. It's ESA's contribution to the ISS running costs and for participation. US-designed rocket deliveries from Orbital Sciences and SpaceX Falcon 9 with the Dragon capsule should take over this role, supported, of course, by the solid and reliable Soyuz system from Russia. On that note, many in the press have been speculating about the growing tension in the Ukraine and Crimea and what effect any possible disagreements have had or will have on the joint operations of the ISS. This seems so far not to have had any impact, although with a threat of sanctions and other challenges on Russia, one assumes that escalations in the region could strain the relationship somewhat. Just before leaving space then, a quick mention for a great podcast I've stumbled across for all of you space geeks, and that is the Space Rocket History podcast by Mike Annis. up to episode 54, the Gemini 2 craft. He's slowly running through all of the rocket launch systems one by one. If you like space, you'll enjoy this program. Finally, before going and adding some debate to the mention of museums, some well worth a visit in the UK over and above those mentioned are, of course, the Fleet Air Arm Museum at Yeovilton. This is Europe's largest naval collection of fixed-wing and rotary aircraft. They also have one of the prototype Concordes there. It's next to the active airfield as well, so if you're lucky enough, along with seeing the new Lynx Wildcat conversion squadron at work, you may get to see the Royal Navy Historic Flight practicing with their Swordfish and Sea Furies. Another couple of museums further north are the South Yorkshire Air Museum, otherwise known as AeroVenture, and of course the Yorkshire Air Museum on the Elvington site, which is the largest independent air museum in Britain, home to the Allied Air Forces Memorial, and it also has a fantastic Cold War collection. I'll try and pick up a few more museums worth visiting over the coming weeks and months and mention them as we go along. This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Thank you, Peter. Peter sent along links to those museums he mentioned, and we'll be sure to put those in the show notes so that you can go check those out. All right, now it's time for some listener mail. And let's start out talking about FLARM. Was that last week we talked about FLARM and we decided that we didn't know that much about it?
You mean
yeah,
as
evidently
in when people...
we were in the minority.
Yeah, we got a lot of mail about this FLARM system. This is for avoiding mid-air collisions. Mark Newton wrote in. He sent us a lot of information about it, noting that this was developed really for gliding because you have situations where you have a lot of gliders in a relatively small airspace and you need a way to avoid collision amongst the gliders.
I thought it was pretty cool. I had never heard of this before he sent this in, and I'm surprised we haven't seen any of it over here in the States.
Yeah, he says that the system includes a GPS receiver, a low-power UHF transmitter, and a small microprocessor, and that all this is packaged up in something about the size of a cigarette box. And very interesting, and I want to thank Mark for that. Also, Peter Johnson sent along some more about FLARM. Peter knows about FLARM. We have a link to a podcast. It's called the Omega Tau Podcast. And I have listened to some episodes of that in the past, but didn't realize that episode 143, which is titled Collision Avoidance with FLARM, includes a conversation with the development manager of avionics at FLARM Technology. So you can learn a lot about FLARM by listening to this Omega Tau podcast.
I'm very proud of you that you said that without cracking up.
Well, you couldn't say FLARM with a straight face last time, could you?
No, I still can't.
On the issue of FLARM use in the U.S., we heard from listener Crawford, who said that it's used fairly widely in sailplanes, particularly in contests in the U.S. So it's very interesting. We always love it when we learn something new about aviation. And if we don't know it, our listeners do, and they let us know. So that's great. We'd also been talking about external cameras on airliners. I think we started talking about this as a way to sort of enhance the in-flight entertainment aspect of flying. And we heard from Tony. He said, just a follow-up, a listener mentioning that the A380 has a tail cam reminded me of one of my favorite aviation books. And this is QF-32. QF-32 was the flight... this is where the Qantas flight, where they had an uncontained engine failure and had to return back. And there's a bit in there about QF-32. He says, after getting overloaded by the error messages that the computer was throwing at the pilots, the author of this book sent the second officer back to have a look out the windows and inspect what was going on. And he says, anyway, back in the back, the second officer's attention was grabbed by another Qantas pilot who was a passenger up the front. The other pilot pointed at the IFE screens. The second officer realized that the whole cabin was watching the IFE. They had heard the bang, seen the explosion, and could now see the fuel leaking from the wings on the IFE. He says, now that's some in-flight entertainment. So, yeah, I hadn't heard that, Rob. That's a little bit of dramatic stuff. That's even better, David, than looking out the window when you can look at the IFE screen and watch the engine
failure.
It's funny
that you say that, because that's the first thing I thought of when I read this, is that, what does that do for David's look out the window and enjoy the view?
Right. And well, it's no worse than that. Those people that the Delta flight that lost 8 feet of wing.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
So I was going to say, that's the one time I recommend not looking out the window.
Have you guys, either of you read that book, QF-32? I really want to see that.
No, I'm going to have to read that. We'll put some information about that in the show notes. Tony also has some other top four aviation books that he suggested. One is Riding Rockets by Mike Mullen, who is on Extended. Also, Woodbine Red Leader by George Loving. It says he flew Spitfires and Mustangs in Europe during World War II. And then the fourth one is Whistling Death, the test pilot story of the F-4U Corsair by Boone T. Guyton. So thanks, Tony, for sending all that to us. Trevor also mentioned on the idea of cameras that Emirates has provided this for years, not just on A380s. He says one on the front wheel strut, it folds up with the wheel retraction, one looking straight down, and one on the tail, as you mentioned. Trevor says all available for passengers to view. Best bit is the nose wheel camera, which enables you to watch lineup and landing, especially at night. That sounds cool. He says BMI also used to have it on their A340, so maybe he's not sure, out of Jeddah. And then he says, what I miss is the ability to listen to live ATC over the entertainment system that Piedmont and United used to provide. Fascinating to listen to. Yeah, wasn't that Channel 9 on United, the ATC?
Yeah. Yeah, for a long time, and then they just got rid of it because they just didn't want people listening to everything.
Yeah.
My best story about that was we landed early when I used to go out to Chicago, and we're on final approach to O'Hare, and we touch down, and they immediately say, you guys are early, head to the penalty box.
Oh, that's good.
That does happen.
And then we sat there for 20 minutes while we were waiting for the gate that was supposed to be available for us to finally be available, but we sat in the penalty box. I thought that was one of the coolest things.
We had mentioned Women in Aviation Week and asked you all to send in your reports, your participation, some feedback on how that went. And we heard from a couple folks. We heard from Aaron. Aaron says that he took his 7-year-old daughter to get her first airplane flight at the event in Seattle at Boeing Field. He says they arrived at Boeing Field for the event hosted by the Seattle Museum of Flight. It was a typical March day in Seattle, drizzling, but above minimums, so a pair of 172s, two Bonanzas, one straight tail, one V-tail, and a Malibu were taking groups of three or four women and girls up for 15 to 20-minute hops around the pattern. Now, he says his daughter, Clara, was a bit nervous while waiting, but made friends with the girl next to her named Claire, who ended up on the same plane. Finally, her turn came, and she was ushered up and into the right seat of the straight-tailed Bonanza. He says she came back 20 minutes later with a big smile on her face and says took a few hours to enjoy the complimentary passes at the Museum of Flight. And Clara decided there that her new favorite airplane was the P-40 Warhawk in the museum's World War II gallery. Now, we have just a really brief recording. Aaron sent along a little recording of he and his 7-year-old daughter after the event, so here they are.
So, Clara, what did you think of your very first flight?
Well, it was fun. We were at the airport, then we took off. And I saw the sea. and some cards. And then we turned back to the airport.
And did you have fun?
Yeah, I had fun.
Do you think you want to be a pilot?
Yeah, I think I want to be a pilot when I grow up.
And what do you have to say to people who are thinking about taking first flight? Do you think they should take flight?
Yeah, people should take their very first flight and see if they have fun.
All right. Thanks, Clara. And thanks, geeks.
I think that's adorable.
If that doesn't make you go for your first flight, I don't know what does.
I know. 7 years old. How cool is that? Bill sent in a note for International Women's Day. He said his local flying club, which is the Victoria Flying Club, they're having a Women in Aviation Day on March 8th. He says they have a very active club. They're working hard to attract people, especially more women into aviation. He also sent us a link to that napkin that someone had written on a WestJet plane addressing the captain about who was a female and had some very, not very nice things to say or not very intelligent things to say about the fact that there was a woman pilot, and that kind of made the rounds. We'll put a link in show notes if you haven't seen that. But he said that WestJet had made their own response to that with a YouTube video. And I think it's titled Dear David in 12E, who I think was the author of the napkin. Let's agree to disagree. And this YouTube video features many, many, many women in WestJet at all levels of the company who are contributing, adding value, and making the company what it is. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Good on WestJet for coming back in this way.
WestJet's really internet savvy, because they're the ones that did the Christmas presents this year, and it is really impressive. They're sort of the Southwest of Canada.
Yeah, and that's a compliment. We also heard from Jamie Dodson, and he says that EAA Chapter 190 supported women in aviation in Huntsville on March 8th. He said five of our pilots flew 44 girls under the EAA Young Eagles program from KMDQ, which is Madison County Executive Airport. He says a local nonprofit, FlyQuest, sponsored the event, and there was also support from KMDQ. And he also sent along some photographs. We'll try to put some of these in the show notes. He says EAA 190 also sponsored a young woman to an all-expense-paid week at EAA Air Academy. He says she's 17 and wants to be a pilot like her great-grandmother, an original 99s member. How cool is that? So we have some photographs from that. Want to thank those listeners who sent in some feedback on the week. And I think that's very encouraging and some great stuff that happened. Micah sent us a link, a veteran to be honored 70 years after refusing a Purple Heart. And this was about a guy who was flying a B-17 bomber in World War II when he was 19. And the B-17 collided with another Allied aircraft, and everyone was killed except this guy, who ended up being stranded behind enemy lines. Well, he escaped and was offered the Purple Heart, but he declined it. So now, 70 years later, he's getting his Purple Heart. So this is another great story. We'll put a link to this in the show notes. This is, it's always kind of heartwarming when you hear about something like this. Somebody who, gave service to their country, and it's nice that even if they didn't want it at first, that they're getting some good recognition. We'll put a link in the show notes to an item that Fred sent us. Skydiver and pilot survive midair collision. You may have seen this. This is a series of photographs where a plane's coming down, or actually a plane's going up, and a skydiver is coming down, and at extremely low altitude, they get tangled up with each other. And miraculously, I think, both survive. I don't know if you took a look at this, Rob, but, when I started looking at this, I'm thinking, wow, this if it hadn't said in the title that they both survived, I didn't think this was going to end up well.
Well, always the guy to throw cold water on an event. I would like to ask the skydiver what in the Sam Hill he was doing landing in the middle of a runway at an airport. Hello? I thought those canopies were a little bit more controllable than that. But my God, of all the places to touch down in the middle of a runway?
So we'll put a link in the show notes. It's not a video. It's a series of stills. It's pretty dramatic.
But doesn't the car always have to give way to the person walking, Robert?
Yeah, pedestrians have right of way.
I mean,
that's true. You're right, and the plane is. But I'm assuming that the pilot didn't see him when he started his takeoff roll. So yeah, at least that's what I'm assuming it was. But again, why in God's name a guy in a chute would want to come down at an airport is beyond me. Unless he was brand new and he didn't know what he was doing.
All right. Well, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank especially our guest, Henry Hartevelt. It's always great to have Henry on the show. Henry H. Hartevelt, right. We learned what the H stands for. We also want to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. And Peter Johnson. Find him at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, let's tell everybody where they can find each of us online. And David Vanderhoof, we will start with you.
The list is long and lengthy. You can find me on DM Vanderhoof at Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. You can find us on the Airplane Geeks page, various other airport pages, and, of course, Thursday mornings, live with Max Flight on the UAV Digest.
Fantastic. And Rob, where do people find you?
Well, hopefully soon they're not going to find me early in the morning because I'll be sleeping in late, which will be something really nice over the last 10 days. But jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter, on Facebook, certainly at the Aviation Minute, which is starting to take off. And and who knows where else you will find me.
All right. Very good. And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google Plus and Twitter. Also at the UAVDigest.com, as David mentioned. And on the PAXX podcast that I co-host with Mary Kirby. Look for that at RunwayGirlNetwork.com. This has been episode 291. You can find full show notes at AirplaneGeeks.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus. Also on Stitcher.com. And you can also find us on TuneIn.com. If you'd like to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we have a listener line where you can leave us a brief audio message. Hunt Benet, tell us something about that.
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet. Find her at aviationqueen.com. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. You can find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening.
That's right. Yeah,
but
gone.
You just that because you wanted to see me, right? Did you see me when I went, "Hi, David, it's me"? Did you see that?
No mention of the Airplane Geeks. You know, I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt that you love us secretly, and you just realize that these people just want you for your body.
Well, when we, I should ship you guys that. Did I ship you guys that picture of Megyn Kelly and I? Well, the funny part of that was that at the end, we said something as a group about pictures, and she said, "Oh, sure, we'll do pictures. I mean, you guys just gather around, and I'll kind of get in the middle." And we said, "No, we don't want pictures of these guys. We just want pictures of you." So she gave each of us, one picture that we did, or one or two shots, nine different times. But it was kind of fun. What color jackets do we get?
We don't get jackets.
We don't get jackets.
Oh, I'm sorry. You probably have like a gold lamé jacket from all the television shows.
No, actually, the one I want is the one that looks like Elvis. You know, the Elvis.
Oh, with the sparkles.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
well, as we all know, Australians and Americans talk about different, you know, same things with different names. I mean, you know, as fanny pack is to bum bag down here in Australia, so too legacy is to classic. And one never, ever, ever calls it a fanny pack in Australia. And off the record, and when we're not recording, we're happy to tell you why that might be. So, yeah, call it a classic. Otherwise, you're going to get really weird looks down here.
And I'll have to decide whether I'm keeping that in the main edit or not.
Hey, I didn't say anything naughty. I didn't say anything nasty. I said, you know, we'll tell you off the record why you never call it a fanny pack. Yeah, you don't know how to come back to that one, do you?
No.